Good afternoon. Have a nice gathering here today. Well-fed people. Although, you know, I think the lesson of a good meal is physical food is just not enough, right? The next morning, you're hungry again. So, but the spiritual meaning of it was important. It was a very nice evening. But today, we are here to celebrate an Exodus. Now, the Old Testament story of the Exodus is fundamental to Egypt, to Israel. It is the story of Israel's redemption. It was, of course, the really big event of the Old Testament, the birth of the nation, demonstration of God's power on their behalf. It was such a big deal that it took God hundreds of years to set it up. He did set it up. He brought Joseph to Egypt. He brought Joseph to power. He used a famine to make Joseph, with Joseph's foresight and Joseph's planning that made Pharaoh, as a result of that famine, immensely rich and powerful. And it was God who caused the famine that brought Israel into Egypt and put them in slavery. And then he let another Pharaoh enslave those people in a bondage so complete, so inescapable, that only God could free them. So it was a long plan, took hundreds of years to unfold, climaxed in the death, maybe a million people. You know, the Passover, if the population of Egypt was around 5 million and all the firstborn died, it might have been a million people. It was probably the deadliest single night in human history, maybe barring some night during the flood. It's no wonder, then, that the Old Testament Passover and the Exodus story is so central to the Old Testament. You know, there are so many references to it in the Psalms and the prophets. But that Exodus is not why we're here today, is it? Their redemption is not the same as our redemption. It was just a type. All that just for an example, according to Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians, it was done as it happened to them for examples, written for our admonition, you know, 1 Corinthians 10:11. Our Exodus is different in many ways. For example, Christ, of course, is our Passover. For all of its drama and its slaughter in the first Passover, that's not our Passover. And yet, despite the differences, we are also redeemed. The New Testament clearly says many places, a score of places, that our salvation is a redemption. And redemption refers to slavery. To be redeemed is to be bought out of slavery. It's deliverance from slavery based on the price paid by a redeemer. Israel's redemption cost the lives of maybe a million Egyptians at the Passover. But we are also redeemed. Not just forgiven. I mean, Christ is more than just the sin offering. Christ is also the Passover. He is the Moses who leads us out. And his death is the death of the firstborn, the purchase price for those in slavery. He's the ransom from slavery. So the real Exodus, the fulfillment of the type, is bigger than the type. In this redemption, though, who is our redemption, the big event? Who is the Pharaoh? That's my question today. In Paul's letter to the Romans, I'd like to highlight who the Pharaoh is in that redemption story. Romans, of course, is Paul's longest letter, where he sets out the whole gospel in a most systematic manner. So we often turn there. Mr. Shaw just went through the heart of it just last week. But today, on this particular day of our redemption, I'd like to just focus on the old master. Who is the old master in that redemption from whom we are redeemed? First of all, I'll start with one verse in Romans 5, verse 14, and just a fragment of it that says, "Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses." Death reigned. Now, this is beginning of a personification, isn't it? It's a figure of speech. Paul's referring to death as reigning, as if death were a person and was a ruler. Death or mortality reigned from Adam to Moses. In all that period of time, everyone died. It reigned over everyone, from Adam to Moses. But then what about after Moses? Did death reign after Moses? You know, we have Moses at the Exodus in Mount Sinai. God had redeemed Israel and then gave them the law, but it was just written on stone, wasn't it? Still, it gave them every advantage, every opportunity. And did it therefore end the reign of death? Well, no, you know that without the Spirit of God, it didn't really help. I think that's probably the big lesson of 1,500 years of Israel's history, is that without the Spirit of God, the law just didn't help. Death continued to reign then from Moses to Christ. And death, therefore, is like the Pharaoh in that sense, that he has ruled all of mankind. The bigger picture, bigger than the Exodus story. But then comes Christ, and Christ conquers death. When he walked out of that tomb, he defeated it. That's the message of chapter 6. Just refer you to verse 9 that says, knowing that Christ, being raised from the dead, dies no more, therefore, I would insert the word therefore, death has no more dominion over him. The old master's rule is broken. Just as Paul says to the Ephesians, I'll just quote you Ephesians 4:8, where he says, he ascended on high, he led captivity captive. That is, when Christ was resurrected, he took the captor captive. And verse 9 says, now this he ascended, what does it mean? But that he also first descended into the lower parts of the earth. That is, Jesus Christ was down in the tomb. He was dead in the tomb, but it could not hold him. In that sense, he has defeated it. Just as he predicted to us in Matthew 16:18, where he says, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He has defeated death, and it cannot hold us as it cannot hold him. It did not hold him. It has no more dominion over him, in the language here of Romans 6. And I think in Paul's mind, this freedom from this absolute ruler of this world is completely analogous. I think what he has in mind is a redemption, just like Israel's redemption. And death is that ruler that from whom we are redeemed. But in verse 6, he uses a different word. Romans 6:6 says, henceforth we should no longer be slaves of sin. Sin, not death. And in verses 7, well, 7 says he died, for he who has died has been freed from sin. And verse 11, likewise you also reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to, not death, but sin. So which is it? Is the old master of our redemption sin, as in verse 7, or death, as in verse 9? Well, it's both. Well, that's an easy compromise, but it is both. In chapter 8, in verse 2, Paul uses the same two words in the same sentence. For the law, he says, this is 8:2, the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law or the rule of sin and death. So it's sin who rules over mankind, and death is our end. It's all one. Until redemption, sin was our nature, and death was our end. That is, from Adam all the way to Christ, it is the kingdom, the world is the kingdom of sin and death. And we are dead to the old master, sin, which is our human nature and the influence of evil upon us, and dead to that old master who is our Pharaoh. Now, sin is repeatedly personified here in this chapter. First, in verse 6 and 7 and 11, which I just noted, and next in verse 13, where we are told not to be instruments of unrighteousness to our old master, which he calls here again sin. And again in verse 16, not to be servants of sin and death, sin unto death. And again in verses 17, 18, and 20, he uses that same personification, servants of sin and free from sin, where sin is that personification. That's about eight times, I think, in the span of 15 verses, where sin is the old master, our Pharaoh. That's my thesis. He's comparing sin and death to the Pharaoh. And finally, like the Pharaoh, he says that this old master offers little or no reward in verse 21. What fruit did you have then in those things of which you are now ashamed? What did you get? For the end of those things is death. Just like under the Pharaoh. Pharaoh employed Israel to build his monuments, and they worked their lives away, but they never had any control over their destiny. They probably had some kind of subsistence of wage, because they didn't starve to death. But they labored as slaves, and in the end, they received nothing but probably an early death. And that is the contrast here between the old master and the new one. Death is a reward no matter how well you do. Lately, I've been thinking about somebody who's doing extremely well as an employee of sin and death. Vladimir Putin, he probably thinks of himself as a virtual pharaoh. I mean, he's the absolute ruler over a lot more people than the pharaoh was. And he's incredibly wealthy. I think he's a very successful servant of the old master. I would even say a key employee lately. But what will the boss do for him? You know, as an example of how high you can get in this world, what will the boss do for him? What will he be paid for his service? No different from what Paul says here. The same as it has always been. Death. He's just mortal. There will be no other reward. So Paul contrasts these two masters. We were in 21. Verse 21 says, what fruit did you have of those things that you are now ashamed of? For the end of those things is death. But he says in verse 22, now, having been set free from sin, the old master, and become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness, and the end, everlasting life. So the contrast between the old master and the new one is total. It's completely opposite. The old one offers you only death. Whether you do good work or bad work, the reward is the same. But the new master offers eternal life. So his question is, why would you want to live any longer under that old master? So today is the day of our redemption from that Pharaoh. It is a redemption from slavery. And the price of that redemption is the firstborn of God himself. Today is the day of our exodus, the really big, the true exodus. It marks the beginning of the journey. It's just the beginning of the journey. But today we leave our Pharaoh with that high hand. We pass from the old master to the new. And, not to forget, today is also the day we collect an offering, as you well know. And we will do that again today. Deuteronomy 16:16 says to do it in the three seasons of the year, and we do it on each holy day because the offering is a part of each holy day. It's an attempt, I think, to keep the feasts in the pattern and the spirit of the scriptures. A little different than it was done back then in the sacrificial system, I think these offerings were what Leviticus would call peace offerings. They were offerings of thankfulness and celebration, which was the nature of the peace offering. They were unique. Peace offerings were unique in that they were the only kind of offering that was eaten by the congregation. You know, you took part, Leviticus is careful to say what part of it you put on the altar and burn, what part of it you take and you give to the priests, but the rest of the offering was eaten by the congregation. It was part of the celebration of that holy day. That's why it was part of the holy day. It was a free will offering, no specific amount. It's an expression of your joy over this holy day and what it means. And so we are likewise going to give an amount that you determine. It's a free will offering according to how we feel blessed. Now, I suppose if we were to emulate the Old Testament, we could pool our money and probably order a pickup load of roast beef or something, and we could eat it here in a celebration for the rest of the weekend, but we're not going to do that. Today we're going to collect it and send it to the home office for the preaching of the meaning of this day, so the world can understand its possible redemption, its freedom, the gospel to all the world. I'm sure each of you has already prepared that offering, or you may have already donated it via online. You can do that. The rest of us are going to put it in a basket. If you don't have an envelope, by the way, just raise your hand and the ushers will get you one. And during the collection of this offering, we are going to enjoy a musical selection performed by Jesse Garcia on guitar. This is something that he wrote himself, and it's entitled Strings of Springs.